Jane Stork, author of a book called Breaking the Spell, subtitled My Life as a Rajneeshi and the Long Journey Back to Freedom. Jane, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Noel.
Because radio is a medium where it's not easy to show what you look like, I'm looking at a reasonably conservatively dressed person with a bob, attractively dressed. You're not wearing pearls, but you could be. And I read the book. Now, the book is, it's a fascinating journey. You're from West Australia, born in Albany.
That's right.
And you and your husband in the 80s got tied up with Bhagwan and with the Rajneeshis. Can you just tell us a little bit how that happened?
Well, I guess it was the first time in my young adult life that I came across a really rough patch in my marriage. There were things happening that I didn't understand. And so I decided I needed somebody to talk to. And I contacted a psychologist with the public health department in Perth. What I didn't know was that that psychologist had just spent his long service leave in India in Bhagwan's ashram. And when I met with him, it was just straight into Bhagwan's meditations, listening to Bhagwan's discourses, his tapes, audio tapes of his discourses. And I was there. I was in it.
So in a way, it was an accidental meeting. And you do talk in the book about communication issues in the marriage and
trying
to break across those communication
issues.
You went for professional advice. It turns out the professional was already a member of the Rajneeshi movement.
That's right. Yes.
And that was the connection.
Yes.
Now, you come out of a Catholic background.
That's right.
Sister and nun at one stage as well.
Yes.
So the family had at least the externals of religious practice going. Did you feel connected to that Catholic background?
I was very much a part of it as a child and as a young woman. I was a very devout Catholic, went to Mass every Sunday, went to confession every week, kept the rules to the best of my ability. And today, when I look back, I can see that the way that I jumped into Rajneeshism was a kind of a reaction to that lifelong, up to that point in my life, devotion to the Catholic Church.
Just to remind those who may not be quite as advanced in years as me or you, certainly those who were around in the 80s would have been watching lurid tales on television of what were, I think, many people called the Orange People.
That's correct. Yes.
Because everybody was wearing that sort of orange clothing.
Right.
Led by a guy called the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, who later became known as Osho, I think was the name. I recall even being in India in the 1980s and picking up a book called The Tantra of Sex by the Bhagwan in a Rajneeshi restaurant. I forget which town I was in, but I remember picking it up. So it was everywhere in the 80s, and there was a famous moment, I think, on television with Mike Willacy, where Ma Anand Sheela, who was second in charge of the movement effectively, in response to a question, responded, "Tough titties."
That's Sheila.
Which you mentioned in the book, of course.
Yes.
I even remember watching that interview. Now, this was an Indian movement.
Right, but one was an Indian national.
Effectively sort of Hindu-Buddhist-ish.
It comes from that Eastern tradition. Bhagwan himself was raised a Jain, which is another sect within Eastern religious
Very
movements.
Keen on the sacredness of life, you know, the extreme Jains wear even covers on the face.
That's right, and they're vegetarians, they don't kill, they don't eat meat, yes.
But it's out of the general Eastern school.
Yes.
What attracted you to it, you and your husband?
For me personally, it was so different to anything I had ever been exposed to. I don't know if you're aware, but Catholics in those days were forbidden to read other literature about other religions. And suddenly to be exposed to somebody, first of all, he was an exotic personality himself, was Indian, and then talking about all the great religious traditions throughout the world, especially throughout the Eastern world, that was, for me, the most exciting thing.
It was intrigue. Was it cultural, partly?
Yes. For me, yes.
Because in the end, you and your then husband, Roger, decided actually to move to India to become more involved in the movement, didn't you?
We did. But we moved to India with a kind of recklessness and madness that should have been suspect to us, but it wasn't. We abandoned everything. We sold or gave away everything we owned. We said goodbye to our friends and family. And we said, we're going to India and we're going to live there with Bhagwan for the rest of our lives.
And you took your two kids, Peter and Carly, with you?
And we took the children, we did. Mm-hmm.
So this was a complete uprooting of the West Australian girl.
That's right.
To India, into an ashram, which is effectively a commune. And the book describes that ashram.
Yes.
But within that ashram, I think it struck me that you learnt a lot more about what the lifestyle of the Rajneeshi was going to be. What were the things that began to show you more about what was asked of you as a sannyasin or as a disciple?
Well, for me personally, one of the most, the biggest thing probably, was that family life didn't exist under Bhagwan's people.
The family was broken up.
The families broke up. And they broke up not because Bhagwan said, break up your family, but because he ridiculed marriage as an old-fashioned institution that had no place in the life of a true seeker. He ridiculed and make fun of people who were trying to maintain long-lasting relationships but having problems now and again. There was a kind of a subtle pressure that wasn't direct, but at the same time it was, to free yourself of all of that.
And instead to attach yourself to the Bhagwan?
Yes, exactly.
So it was cult. It was effectively a cult-like.
Yes. In retrospect, I see that very clearly. If you leave your husband, your children, your family behind you, then you become very isolated. And in this situation of being isolated, you start attaching to the master, to the guru. And that's what happened.
The kids were there, though, and your husband were there, but the kids lived separately. At first you were together, but then you moved.
That's right. We lived together as a family at first for the first couple of years, and then we all moved into separate accommodation. So we broke up as a family unit all at the same time.
Now, it's also true that the Bhagwan had effectively, this we'll be putting it crudely, but I think it's fair to say, a doctrine of free love operating in the organisation, where it was seen that, you know, sexual commerce was not to be taken too seriously, it was fun, it was to be, you know, pretty much at will.
Exactly.
And that was, you're coming out of a Catholic background, of course,
right,
out of the expectations with a sister who was a nun. Suddenly you and your then husband, Roger, were being expected to, well, how about this one over here, or how about that one over there? How did you get across that in your head?
Well, I wasn't doing too much thinking at that time, you know. I was just going with the flow, as they say. I was very conservative, and I wasn't particularly sexually active.
There's a sense in the book of that. Each time you talk about it in the book, I can sense you distancing yourself somewhat from it, but nevertheless the doctrine is there.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And because I myself didn't feel so involved in it, I didn't mind if other people were. That was kind of okay. That was their business and whatever. So I managed to find a niche for myself within this free love doctrine.
But you note also that STDs were rife at the ashram, particularly herpes, for example.
Yes.
And this was just taken for granted that it would happen.
Yes, unfortunately.
There were other shocks as well, though, because I another little tiny story there when your son Peter and your daughter Kylie, you're talking about there was a problem with lice and having to comb lice out of their hair.
That was an ongoing problem for the entire time that we were in India.
And this is just a case of standards being different to Australia?
Yes, I think it was impossible at that time in our lives for the children not to have lice.
Just everybody did,
because they were running around freely the whole time. They were playing with the kids on the street, also Indian kids on the street, and they just passed the lice around.
Let's break up for a little song, though, because these songs each that you've chosen tell us something a little bit more about Jane Stork. What about Galway Bay? I'll ask you about it in just a moment. This is a Bing Crosby version.
If you ever go across the sea to Ireland, then maybe at the closing of your day, you will sit and watch the moon rise over Cleda, and watch the barefoot gossoons at their play, just to hear again the ripple of the trout stream, the women in the meadows making hay, and to sit beside a turf fire in the cabin, and see the sun go down on Galway Bay. For the breezes blowing o'er the seas from Ireland are perfumed by the heather as they blow, and the women in the upland digging praties speak a language that the strangers do not know. For the strangers came and tried to teach us their way. They scorned us just for being what we are, but they might as well go chasing after moonbeams or light a penny candle from a star. And if there's going to be a life hereafter, and faith, I'm sure there's going to be, I will ask my God to let me make my heaven in that dear land across the Irish Sea.
Galway Bay by Bing Crosby. Choice of our guest, Jane Stork, author of Breaking the Spell. Jane, that has memories for you, that song.
That has really strong memories for me, because my father sang that song throughout my childhood. His mother was of Southern Irish descent, and although Dad was born and raised in Australia, he had a very strong connection to his Southern Irish heritage, and that was one of his favourite songs. He also loved Bing Crosby. He sang all Bing Crosby songs.
So, it sounds like a conventional Australian home.
It was.
And there's been this extraordinary journey. I'd like to get into some of the tougher stuff, because you first went to India, the family relocated to India. There were all sorts of experiences there. You actually became quite key in the hierarchy. You rose through the hierarchy. You were a trusted member of the Rajneeshi movement. In fact, quite a senior member.
That's true. That happened later, not in India. In India, I was still an innocent, if you like. When Bhagwan moved to America in 1981, I followed him there. I was one of the first Rajneeshis on the new property in Oregon. Bhagwan arrived on that property just the day or two after I got there. And it was circumstances that put me then in close touch with Sheila. I worked closely with Sheila, and over the years, I became, as you say, a trusted member.
This is Ma Anand Sheila.
This is Ma Anand Sheila.
Tough Diddy Sheila.
That's right.
That's right. Who was the face of the Rajneeshi movement, I think, in media. She's the one who did all the media interviewing.
She was the face and the voice of Bhagwan.
What had happened in India was there was sort of, an unravelling of the closer family ties you had, although not completely, because you keep talking about your kids and you do mention your husband, and there is obviously contact going on there. But it's no longer a nuclear family in the sense that you'd have in Australia.
That's right.
And then you all, the entire family, ends up, not all at the same time, but in America.
Right.
The purpose being to establish the Bhagwan's new town in America, effectively.
That's right.
You were there founding a religious town.
Yes.
Tell us the process. You arrived in the city of Mud, I think you described
it. Well, it wasn't a city at all. It was just a ranch. It was called the Big Muddy. That was the name it was officially known by, the Big Muddy, and it was big and it was muddy. And we started from scratch. Rajneeshis came from all over the world, worked incredibly hard, put in a complete infrastructure, built everything.
This was near, I think, the town called Antelope.
Antelope was a small town, almost a ghost town, in central Oregon. That was the closest town.
And what those sort of local Antelope people saw was the descent of hundreds and eventually, I think, thousands of people dressed in orange with beads on, beards, and with a most unusual lifestyle for people who are in a small American country town, virtually a ghost town.
They must have thought that suddenly they'd landed on the moon. By that time, we had changed our orange clothes to red. The orange had got darker and darker until it became red. The men did shave off their beards when they went to America.
There was a cultural concession.
There was a cultural concession. They wore jeans, red jeans. But the beads remained, and this incredible activity remained. I think it was the incredible activity and the speed with which things happened that was most frightening.
Now, this is where it gets very interesting, America, though, because the photo in your book, when I look at you, your son and your daughter as well, you all have gentle brown eyes, all of you, and it strikes me that these are calm sort of faces, gentle sorts of faces. When that town is being established in Antelope, the Big Muddy, there's a lot going on and a lot starts to go, shall we say, awry pretty quickly. It's in that town that you become quite central to administration. You become trusted by Ma and Aunt Sheila, Tough Titties. You become really her right-hand woman. And also you get in between or find yourself aware of political intrigues within the movement itself as it tries to establish itself in America and Antelope.
That's true. While my association with Sheila was to lead me into enormous trouble and strife.
In fact, prison.
It also, I'm in a way grateful that I became so closely involved with Sheila, because it was through that I became aware of what was going on behind the scenes. Most Rajneeshis, almost all, had no idea what was going on behind the scenes. They believed the benign, loving features of this father-like, wise man, Bhagwan, but they had no idea what was really happening.
Not unlike Catholics of the 1950s, pray, pay and obey sort of thing.
Yes, yes.
And so your entry into that sort of inner circle meant you started to see the machinations that were going on.
That's true. I didn't want to see them at the time. I tried very desperately not to acknowledge that things weren't the way I thought they were, but it was unavoidable, and I became more and more involved, aware of what was happening.
Now, there were clashes. Those local townspeople at Antelope became quite alarmed at the thousands of orange or red people.
Yes, and also they had reason to be, because although at first everything was well-intentioned and people were friendly towards each other, very quickly when opposition grew, because there was no provision for building a town on a ranch, it was zoned rural, and the zoning wasn't right. So there was a lot of opposition.
There were planning breaches being negotiated, but
yes,
but the building went on, as it were.
And Bhagwan ordered that as many properties in Antelope as possible be bought up, and Rajneeshis moved into them. And Rajneeshis became the majority in that already very small town and took over the school and the local government.
And so there was a sense of the Rajneeshi culture sort of engulfing the local culture, which was much smaller.
Yes, and those people were mostly somewhat elderly people. So it was for them, I can see today, extremely frightening.
Like an invasion.
Yes.
The first incident I think that happens is what we'd now describe as a bioterrorist attack, which is the allegation made, a food poisoning event. Tell us about that.
I had no personal involvement or knowledge of that at the time. Later, I did find out about it, and it's true that certain Rajneeshis introduced salmonella into salad bars in a nearby town, in the town of the Dalles. That was the center of local government in Central Oregon.
What was their purpose?
As I understand it, the purpose was to make as many people in that town ill as possible so that they would not go to vote in the local elections.
So there was a conspiracy in retrospect which was organised, and which in retrospect now you'd just shake your head at. Had you known at the time, it might have alarmed you.
Yes, I think so. But it's very hard to say, because I say in that frame of mind that I was in those days, I was not questioning. So although I didn't know about it, I also can't say how I would have reacted had I known.
I'll come to that later. I do want to ask you about how you found yourself immersed, how you can look now on how you were there, and I might even ask you to try to put yourself back there later. But for the moment, I'm really interested in focusing on these events to get a sense of the enormity of what ended up happening in this place. That bioterrorist attack, the poisoning of food with salmonella to try to rig elections effectively, was one thing that you weren't directly involved in. But then later on, there seems to be a growing craziness. I'm an outsider, so I look on it from an outside point of view, of course. But it seems the group around Ma Anand Sheela and that central group start to get into a sort of a crazy space where they are very worried about the Bhagwan's physician and the influence the physician had on the Bhagwan, and that there was in fact a plan to murder him.
That's true, and you're quite right in calling it craziness. I think insanity is probably a better word.
You knew about this at the time, though, didn't you?
I did. There were two things going on as far as that's concerned. This madness that was getting out of control. One was dealing with outside opposition, and one was dealing with what were perceived to be people who were dangerous to Bhagwan within the commune.
So there's a certain paranoia reigning within the cult,
yes,
as it were.
Yes, a real paranoia.
Directed two ways, to the outsiders who are non-Rajneeshi, but also inside Rajneeshi enemies.
Yes.
And you were in the Ma Sheela camp.
Yes.
And there was, later on, of course, you were convicted of conspiracy in regard to this, along with others.
That's right.
And that internal ruction, where Ma Sheela and others were very worried about the influence that the Bhagwan's doctor was having on him and the advantage he had, led to a conspiracy to murder him. And you were subsequently convicted in the US, and you were given 2 years in prison for it.
That's right. For my attempting to murder Bhagwan's doctor.
It did actually happen, the attempt, didn't it?
It did actually happen, I'm ashamed to say.
The details of that I'll leave for people to read in the book. It's fascinating. As it turns out, he didn't die, of course. The attempt, I won't ruin the story, but nevertheless, the attempt was made, you were part of it. It's amazing to think. You look so innocent. It's amazing to think. Now, that's the first part of the craziness. It gets worse, though, doesn't it?
It gets much worse.
There was a further conspiracy, a much more serious one, which emerged to assassinate Charles Turner, the then United States Attorney for the District of Oregon. I mean, I think people's worst paranoid fears about the Rajneeshis are fulfilled in this. What was that all about?
Again, Mr. Turner was, and I think very wrongly today, perceived to be a direct threat to Bhagwan. This whole paranoia that grew up, it all revolved around protecting Bhagwan, Bhagwan's person, keeping Bhagwan's person safe.
This was the guy with the multiple Rolls Royces parked outside, who used to drive through with jeweled watches, and who was actually making a fortune while thousands of people worked on the commune trying to make it work.
That's right. They worked 7 days a week, at least 10 hours a day, and were not paid.
And at the same time people are so desperate to protect him, a plot is hatched to kill the United States Attorney for the District of Oregon.
Yes.
I think it's time for a piece of music. Let's have Rock Around the Clock.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on, join me, hon. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. We're going to rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes two, three, and four, if the band goes down, we'll yell for more. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. We're going to rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're going to rock around the clock tonight.
Bill Haley and Rock Around the Clock. You're on ABC Radio with me, Noel Devine, and my guest, Jane Stork, author of Breaking the Spell. Rock Around the Clock was a choice of yours. I know I didn't put it in exactly the right place. It just struck me that it might fit there. It really comes from the uni days, doesn't it?
It does, although it fits where you put it, Noel.
well, the whole thing is sort of going sort of crazy. And the story goes on from there. In the end, you also receive firearms training on the ranch?
That's correct. We were trained, a large group of us were trained by two former South African Army officers.
To shoot a gun?
Not just a gun, also semi-automatic weapons.
I'm really finding it hard to imagine, but I believe you did.
We did.
What was the purpose?
To protect Bhagwan.
In case. So the paranoia is reigning supreme.
Yes.
I have to ask, how deep was this devotion? You're learning to shoot guns. There are conspiracies going on to kill state officials. It's another world from the outside, but it must have made sense to you somehow at the time?
Simply because I was so blind, I wanted to believe that Bhagwan was the saviour of the world, that he would save me, my family, and the world. I wanted desperately to believe that. And so I pushed away any thoughts that might have come, or any concerns I may have had, or any questions I might have had about what was happening. I was with an enlightened master, and so whatever he wanted, whatever he said should be, then I would do it. And I was ready, as we know, to kill for that.
I suppose I struggle trying to understand. Your husband, so I know the marriage wasn't a strong one. You talk about why that marriage didn't particularly work. But your kids are there as well. And it strikes me through this book that there is certainly, though you describe a sort of a disintegration of the nuclear family, there is a sense in this book of a very fierce mother's love all the way through. Could they not pull you away from this? How were your kids figuring in relation to your devotion to the Bhagwan?
Well, I think the initial act of taking them away from the family in Australia, away from friends, and moving to India, that did something. So that once we were there, there was no going back. And I never thought of the children as being separate from what I was doing. And in a way, especially when the madness and the paranoia set in, it was intensified by the knowledge that my children were also in this community and that I needed to protect Bhagwan and that community.
Because your children were part of it?
Because my children were a part of it.
The next stage of this, of course, is the community realizes the law is going to close in. This was initially about the attempted murder of the Bhagwan's doctor.
That's correct.
At that stage, I think, if I'm remembering the story correctly, there was a decision to flee.
That's not quite right. When I attacked Bhagwan's doctor with the intention of killing him, the law, the police, were never involved. Bhagwan knew about it because his doctor told him about it.
It was hidden inside, yeah.
It was hidden inside. So there was no overt threat from law enforcement at the time.
Have I got the sequence wrong? Because I thought it was 1986 that those charges were made.
It was 1985 when we left. The decision to leave came for myself. The decision to leave came the day I attacked that doctor, because I knew that I had moved so far away from everything I knew to be right that even though I didn't understand anything more than that, I knew I had to get out.
That was your turning point?
That was my turning point.
You'd been part of the conspiracy, you'd made the attempt, and you just went, what am I doing?
Exactly. I came here, I came to that community for meditation, for peace, for harmonious living, and it had come to that, and I knew I had to get out. I didn't leave right away because it was almost impossible for me to leave the master. I had been with him for 9 years. I had given everything. I had nothing left back there that I had left. I had no friends anymore back home in Australia.
And you basically sold everything to be there.
We had, Roger and I had gotten rid of everything. We had sold and given away everything. I had not kept in touch with friends and family. That was my world.
And during that time in America, you also divorced Roger.
That's right.
And at the end, when the fleeing happened, I think you went to Switzerland first, and you somehow ended up in Germany. Is that right?
A number of us decided at the same time to leave. First, Sheila announced that she was leaving. When I heard that, I knew that if Sheila could leave, I could leave too.
And you were devoted to Sheila.
I was very devoted to Sheila. But more than 20 people left at that time, many of them very old sannyasins. They had been with Bhagwan even longer than I had. And it was agreed that we would meet up in Germany because we had nothing. And we was more or less to meet together to decide what to do next. How were we going to support ourselves? What were we going to do with our lives?
You were, in the end, though, arrested and sentenced and served jail over that conspiracy.
I was, because when we left, Bhagwan attacked verbally with all his cunning and might Sheila and those who had left with him.
The traitors to us.
The traitors. If Sheila could leave, anybody could leave. So he had to make sure that those of us who had left became traitors, an anathema to Rajneeshis.
And he effectively exposed the conspiracy
he
that
did.
Had gone on.
He called on law enforcement authorities himself to come in to investigate Sheila's behavior.
And you were convicted, and you describe in the book the feeling of being locked up.
Yes. It was a physical imprisonment that was impossible to ignore, whereas I had been in a mental, psychological imprisonment for 9 years and I had effectively ignored it. But when that became a physical imprisonment, it was also a wake-up call.
It came down that I'm now in jail.
Yes, yes.
How did this happen? Don't I come from Albany in Perth and aren't I a normal mother and...
Yes.
That's not the end of it, though, because when you were released from jail, you actually rejoined Ma Sheila.
Sheila was still in prison when I was released, because Sheila was also imprisoned at the time.
But sometime after that,
yes,
you did rejoin her. Yeah.
I did. I joined a group, a very small group of sannyasins, ex-sannyasins in Germany, and Sheila, when she was released, joined too. I was still very devoted to Sheila.
Now, that's where you met your new partner, George, though, too, which I think is part of your salvation.
It's a very big part of my salvation, that I met a man who loved me, who accepted me despite everything.
He knew all about this. He knew the imprisonment. He knew all the history, and he loved you, and he wanted to be with you.
Yes, and he stood by me like a pillar of strength ever since.
And he was part of your ability over a period of time to start to separate yourself even from Ma Sheila.
Exactly.
Who you were still devoted to.
Yes. For the first time in my life, I think, I really got my feet on the ground. I felt safe with George. I knew he wasn't going to chase after the next woman who ran across his path. And we built a relationship, a really strong relationship together. And it was through this that I was able to separate myself.
Start to break the spell.
Yes. Yes.
Saddest part of the story for me when I was reading this, there was a reason why you gave yourself up.
16 years later, yes.
You gave yourself up to American authorities.
Yes.
And that's a very personal matter which you discuss in the book. Tell us about it.
First, let's go back a bit. When I was arrested the second time, the German High Regional Court refused to extradite me. They had extradited me once already, 5 years earlier, and they refused the extradition. But there remained an international arrest warrant out there for me, so I was only safe in Germany.
You had to stay there, yeah.
Yes. So for the next 16 years, I lived in Germany and didn't cross the border.
Where were Carly and Peter at this stage?
Peter and Carly were, at first they were in America, but eventually they came back to Australia with their partners. They had their children here in Australia. Roger also returned back to Australia.
So you were a grandmother by this stage, but you couldn't actually see your grandchildren.
That's right. And then 16 years after that, Peter got a brain tumor. My son Peter got a brain tumor. And I knew that if I were ever to see him again, I had to face the complete responsibility for what I'd done And that's when I made the decision to go and give myself up and throw myself at the mercy of the court in America.
There's a lot of struggle in this book. I mean, you talk a lot about how you struggled trying to be honest in your own head and then trying to come to terms with the gravity of what had gone on. But I suppose this one was an important one. Your son, as far as you knew, was seriously, seriously ill.
Yes.
You'd not seen his children. And the only way you were going to get to be able to come back to Australia to see them was to hand yourself over back to American authorities. And this time it was over the conspiracy to murder Charles Turner, the United States Attorney for Oregon.
That's right.
What happened?
It was an extremely serious charge. And I was facing many years in prison. But my son was ill and I wanted to see him again. And I knew that I had no choice. I just had to own up to everything and take whatever came.
How was George, your new partner George, the one who you speak so highly of in this book?
He just stood by me. He didn't want me to go because we knew it. I could very well receive many years imprisonment. But he understood and he supported me completely in my decision.
So you came into the court. What happened?
First time when I flew to America, I came into the court and I acknowledged my guilt.
You fessed up to the whole lot?
Everything. And the judge, in an extraordinary act, allowed me to leave America and to go to Australia to be with Peter and Kylie and their families for the 4 months until sentencing. That was a different date. It was 4 months later. So I was able to, having confessed fully to what I had done, I was allowed to leave America and go to Australia to be with my children.
And when you arrived, how was Peter?
He was very happy to see me. He was really happy to see me. Both my children were. I said in the book, and I've never seen my children so beautiful. They are beautiful children, but they were so beautiful that day.
Both good-looking children.
Yes.
I mean, they look like you, and they're both good-looking children.
Yes. Mm. And Peter was, at that time, he had already had two operations for the tumour. His diagnosis was he had a tumour that was going to kill him, but he had already had two operations to slow down that process. And he was quite well, given the circumstances, when I went. So we had 4 lovely months together. And then I had to return to America to face sentencing, and I didn't know what would happen.
Well, you're sitting in front of me now. It's 2009, so it doesn't look like you've got a long jail sentence. What happened?
It was a miracle. That's what happened. The judge sentenced me to time served and said very specifically that he meant the 3 months I had served in extradition custody when I had been arrested in 1990. And I walked out of the courtroom a free woman.
That was because, though, you cooperated?
It was because the judge showed mercy towards me. I didn't cooperate in the sense of I had nothing to give.
It was all known already.
It was all I could never have. There was nothing I had to offer them except my complete submission to the court. And that's what I did.
So you were actually allowed to leave again?
Yes.
And Peter?
I returned to Australia. Not immediately. I had to go back to Germany first. But then I returned to Australia and I was with Peter for the last months of his life and when he died.
And George and Kylie also with you?
Kylie is married and has a family. She was living 2 minutes drive from where Peter lived, so
they could see each other.
She was always around, yes. And George had to work back home in Germany, but he came whenever he could. But we spent, during that time of Peter's illness and the situation with the court, George and I were separated altogether for almost a year. Because I was either in Australia with Peter or in America.
He sounds an incredible man.
He is. I'm very lucky.
Well, look, it's a fascinating book, Breaking the Spell, My Life as a Rajneesi and the Long Journey Back to Freedom. There's a lot of personal tragedy in there. There's a lot of soul-searching in it, and we've just touched the surface in this interview. Can we finish on a song which I know is special to you? And as I was reading through the book, The Death of Peter, Your Son, as a Young Man, is a really tragic thing and a terrible thing for a parent to experience. Of course, his own wife, his children. But you chose this song for him. Tell us about it. Don't worry, be happy.
It was about 1 week before Peter died. He was no longer able to speak. He was very weak. And his very best friend was visiting with him. And as his friend was leaving, they were holding hands and looking at each other. And Peter was trying very hard to say something. And the words wouldn't come out. And then all of a sudden he started to hum. And he's hummed.
Jane Stock, thanks for being with us on Sunday nights.
Thank you, Noel. It was a pleasure.
Don't worry, be happy.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy.